When my son was much younger, I had still a mom bag that I carried everywhere around me. It wasn't quite the diaper bag anymore, but it was a bag full of stuff. And it was often backpack-sized, depending on where we were going. Now, I like to make sure in my mom bag that I was ready for about any situation, so that way I could minimize whatever chaos might ensue around us. And I was quite diligent with my mom bag. It had, you know, like Boy Scout, Eagle Scout level kind of preparedness to make sure that we were ready for wherever we would go. And my husband was grateful that I took care of the mom bag because he knew I'd just be ready for whatever. But he also recognized that sometimes I would get a little obsessive about the mom bag and making sure I was always ready for whatever. And sometimes he's like, come on, we just gotta go. So, and this is good. This is why it's good that we're married, because then we kind of meet in the middle and we get somewhere. But there was one time where we were on vacation, and so, of course, on vacation, the mom bag is a staple item because you're just all over the place and you never know what would happen. And we were up north doing a number of different hikes, and we decided to take a stop and do a certain little trail, and my husband said, Stina, let's just get our binoculars, let's go. Come on, it's not gonna be that long of a hike. You don't need the bag. So I know that you're already laughing, right? This is not, so we get going and we start, you know, tramping. And our son is a good, I've mentioned to you that our family likes birding. And my son is such a good sport. So here's little, you know, 4-year-old kid with his binoculars and hiking with us and being a good sport, doing something mom and dad like doing. And we get about a half a mile into the hike, and what happens? I'm hungry, right? And in that moment, my husband just went like, you have got to be kidding me. The one time I encourage my wife not to bring the mom bag is the one time, you know, 20 minutes into the hike or whatever it was that, you know, you're about to fall apart into pieces. And I tried to not do the I told you so moment because that's not helpful. And I just kind of said, we both kind of looked and saw if we could just kind of encourage, you know, because sometimes you can say, oh, it's not that much further. Come on, you're not that hungry. You just ate an hour ago. You know, keep going. Oh, no. There was no negotiating. It was like, stop on the ground. I'm hungry. If you don't have a snack, you better carry me back to the car. And so I just said, why don't you just go ahead? I'll take him back to the car. I'll take care of the things. It'll be fine. And we all he kind of said, no, we'll all go back. And we all kind of tromped back dejectedly, you know, and got back to the car. And we still talk a lot about that story to this day, about the I'm starving, are we there yet? I want to go home. And I'm assuming that for many of you, whether or not you have children or have been a child at some point in your life, you have an experience where you have been on the road and there is a moment where you say, are we there yet? I'm starving. I want to go home. That's what's happening in our story today. In our portion of the Exodus, the Israelites have been in the wilderness for a month. And you know, I can make a joke because my child wasn't really starving, right? It was just an inconvenience. But in this case, they were at a portion in their story where they didn't know where they were going to get their food. They didn't even know where they were going, and they wanted to go home. Now, if you're joining us in the middle of this sermon series, we have been going through the Exodus since September, and so we have journeyed through the story of the Israelites in their search for freedom. We've talked about the first few chapters of Exodus, about the struggles of the people that that would become the Israelite nation and how they were kept in slavery and wondered where God was when they needed God. And we are told in the scriptures that God sees, hears, understands, and acts. And that he raises up Moses and Aaron as human leaders, but we are shown again and again that this Exodus story is really about how God leads the way. And we have gotten through portions in our story where when God chose to show up and act, it was very dramatic. We know, of course, of the burning bush story, but we also talked through very dramatic cosmic powers where God and Pharaoh confront one another, and we are entering into those portions of Scripture where we have to wrestle and think about things like the plagues, the Passover, and the parting of the Red Sea. And last week we did get to the Red Sea and talked about how God interceded, making a way through the chaos of the waters, protecting them from the violence of the past. And I mentioned that in getting through that moment of salvation history where God interceded and saved them and led them to freedom, that was only the beginning. And this is where we pick up our story. The Israelites have crossed the Red Sea, but they haven't quite made it to the Promised Land yet. And in this portion of the story in particular, they begin their grumbling. Now, it's easy to pick on the Israelites in these stories, right? Oh, they were so whiny. All they do is complain, complain, complain. And they do a lot of grumbling in Exodus. I mean, I will not kid you on that. But I think it's important for us to take seriously their cries and their grumbles and how it reveals not only their struggles, but maybe some of the struggles we also face today. We hear in chapter 16, starting with verse 2, that the whole Israelite community complained against Moses and Aaron in the desert. The Israelites said to them, "Oh, how we wish that the Lord had just put us to death while we were still in the land of Egypt. There we could sit by the pots cooking meat and eat our fill of bread. Instead, you've brought us out into this desert to starve this whole assembly to death." Strong words. And we hear from the Israelites in their grumbling that they are at a position in their stress of being in the wilderness, a desire to go back into slavery? Really? Because as they remember it, oh, we had our fill. We had more than enough to eat. It wasn't that bad. And not only in their grumbling do they start romanticizing the past and that maybe it wasn't that bad, that they should go back, but they also begin to grumble about their leadership and place their anxieties and their fears and their stress upon Moses and Aaron, as if these two people were the ones who were trying to cause them harm. Which is why in the scripture reading, you hear these questions of Moses and Aaron saying, "What? Why are you blaming me? I'm here with you in the wilderness." And we have those points. But then if we were to go deeper into their grumblings, we begin to get a sense, as Moses points out, that what they're really grumbling about is not necessarily a longing for the past or even a distrust of Moses, but there's a deep grumbling they have against God. And I think that is something worth pausing over. It's easy to look at those Israelites and go, "Ugh, there they were, just grumbling. They didn't, you know, appreciate what they had." But if we pause and we take a moment to think about this Israelite nation's journey, these are a people who had lived generations in slavery, who had seen horrific acts of violence. And where was God when they needed God? Why did God take so long to act? And then, of course, when God does act, the parts they see of God are incredibly powerful and yet somewhat terrifying. Just think about those plagues. Think about that parting of the Red Sea and what happened with the Egyptians. And now they were following this God in the desert, not knowing what would happen to them. I think it only right that they be somewhat scared out of their minds, about trembling in fear as to what this God might do to them. And so I think it's fitting, in the beginning of this wilderness journey, after we hear of the power of God to prevail, we begin to see a more tender side of God to provide. This is when the manna, the quail, the water appear for the people. God chooses to be the one to show that God will care for these people. God will not only lead them, but God will attend to their needs and hear their cries. It says in verse 11, the Lord spoke to Moses, "I've heard the complaints of the Israelites." And that was a very important part, especially in the first part of the Exodus, right? There was a lot of hearing and seeing, and it was God who understood. And so here, God understands once more and says, "Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat. In the morning you will have your fill of bread. And then you will know that I am the Lord your God." And so we have this act of the quail appearing and the manna that miraculously appears. And what is the Israelites' response? What is this? In my household, we've been having fun about the word manna because even though I don't really know anything about Hebrew, I know enough of the keywords to be dangerous, and that the word manna is a play on words, the Hebrew words and phrase, "What is it?" And so when we have this manna, this dew-like sticky stuff showing up on the ground that they're going to eat, and they say, "What is it?" It's kind of like an episode of Who's On First? Yes, who's on first? You know, it's like, what is it? Yes, that's what we're going to call it, like a whatchamacallit. No one really has the words for this. And there's this humor that unfolds. And they don't know what to do with how God chooses to respond and act and care for their needs. It's strange and it's disorienting, and they're not sure how to eat this stuff and collect this stuff and how long it'll last. And I think that's so telling of our own experiences of when God intercedes and acts in our lives. So often, God hears our cries, and God answers, and we go, "What is that?" We don't know what to make of the manna that appears. And we hear in the Exodus story that after it appears on the ground, they are given some instructions as to how to collect and store it. And they are warned not to keep any extra. They should only take enough to basically be their daily bread. And when they collect their daily bread, we are told that God gives according to their needs. It's not like everybody gets the same exact amount of manna. Each household, each person is given and collects what they need. And it might be different depending on the needs of the individuals. And we are given this beautiful image of God caring and feeding and watching over the people as they learn to become a new people together with God as their leader. But yet in this teaching and this lesson of manna, we are also reminded and told that they should not collect more than what they need. Because if they do, it will rot and melt away. And we are given the story of those who have trouble believing in God's providence and think maybe today God will show up and help, but probably not tomorrow, so I better, you know, keep a little extra. And we are in that desire to hoard or keep extra. It just creates this putrid, rotting mess. And in the story of the manna, we are told not only that God will provide and care and teach the people what it means to have their daily bread, but also God will instruct and help them practice what it means to rest. And we are given a reintroduction of the practice of Sabbath keeping, as initially shared in Genesis, right? In Genesis 1, where we have, and then on the seventh day, God rested. And here we have, in this emergence of a new nation, as God provides for their daily bread, they are also instructed to rest. And that there will be a day for them to collect extra for the Sabbath, but they should not go out and continue working. In fact, it says that it's not really worth going out because you're not going to be able to get anything. There won't be any manna, and that's what happens. There is nothing to collect. I think it really fascinating that not only in the beginning of this relationship building between God and the people is there that tenderness of God to provide the manna, and to help us understand the disciplines of moderation in what it takes to have our daily bread. But they are also given the practice to rest and set apart time for God. It's fitting to remember, especially for these Israelites, that in their slavery, they would not have been given the opportunity to ever rest. Only people who are free can rest. And that's what we will learn when the Ten Commandments come. But right now we are given that simpler admonition, the importance of caring for one's body, the food that we eat, the water we drink, and the rest needed for our souls. And we are also given the warning of what happens when we are led to excess, or when we choose not to rest, and the dangers that come of it. I also think it's fascinating that as God is interceding with the people here in the wilderness, that we have these stories of manna and quail and Sabbath keeping before we get to the Ten Commandments. That'll come next week, and you'll want to see it. But here, we have this image of God saying, you know, before we set down a lot of house rules, how about we try some house practices? How about we figure out what it means to live together as a people? To know that you can trust me, and I'm going to be there for you. And that sometimes there are going to be things that I ask you to do, I'm saying as God here, that you're not going to understand, and you're going to say, what is it? But trust me, it's for your own benefit. It's for your well-being, and it's because I love you. I think that's a good lesson for all of us to remember wherever we are in the wilderness. Because I know how easy it is for me to let life be overcomplicated, to forget that God is God, that God is always reaching out to provide for me what I need. Sometimes I'm off looking for something that I want and not what I need, and that's a different sermon, isn't it? But God is always faithful. God always will provide. God, and I might say, what is it? But God will show me. I also think about in this story of the manna and the quail and the tenderness of God, how important it is that there is that image of things that rot when we hold too closely. You know, around the same time as that mom bag trip that I told you about, I was also at a position in my life, in my mom bag lifestyle, where I was holding on to a lot of things. And some of those were important things to manage our household. But some of the things were things that I needed to physically let go of. And for me, in that phase of my life, they were physical things. They weren't just like metaphorical, oh, I should spend more time doing this or that. No, it was the junk in my basement. And for some of that, there were things that I was keeping, especially when it came to baby items, that I was holding on to. And I was not willing to let them go. And eventually, in that same time, in my mom bag moments, God very clearly and very tenderly showed up to me and reminded me that by hoarding that stuff in my basement, it was like manna rotting away. And I needed to do something about it. And I was not very happy with God in pointing that truth out to me. And so I took a little bit of time to reflect on, well, what would that mean to let it go so that it wasn't just rotting away? And it became clear there were people who kept crossing my path who needed something that I had and could use it that day. They consistently came before me. I mean, it was unforced, and it was something that once I was willing to let go of my iron fist, that it became easy to release and share. And it became delightful to see what life that stuff had still in it. It was not doing any good in my basement. As much as I wanted it to stay with me, I needed to share it. I needed to let someone else use it so it could be a blessing in their life. And I found that in the giving and the letting go, there was a chance for God to be tender in my life, to be able to talk with me about the memories, maybe the dreams that had been left unfulfilled, and recognize that this was my daily bread that was needed somewhere else now. And this is the strange, hard work we do in our lives with God, in to take each day as what we need, to release what is no longer ours, and to trust that God will continue to provide and lead us on.